Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Anatomy of a Genocide Survived and a Survivor's Quest to Learn the Truth About It. So unfolds Black Earth Rising, Netflix's groundbreaking miniseries launching worldwide Friday. Peabody winning writer director Hugo Glick joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Get ready to hear Joker, 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 again from Snoop Dogg, as the primetime version of The Joker's Wild moves to TNT tonight for season 3. Executive producer Victor Rubino, no Joker, comes on next half hour. Crime and a subculture collide tonight on the debut of Pure, WGN America's first new scripted series of 2019. Creator and showrunner Michael Amo will set the stage for you next hour live from Canada. Also ahead, Shopify breaks into television, Bobby Vernon sets an FX date, Kate Winslet's latest HBO project, Hulu pricing, our continuity question, and a special announcement. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum. I'm a casting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, it's Wednesday. It's my birthday. And tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, proudly loved partner of the annual New York Television Festival, and the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get 3 free audiobooks when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Great to have you with us on this midweek here on the program All About Television. 42 degrees. Yes, we are out of the free zone. At the top of the hour, we have some fantastic guests for you in the 90 minutes ahead. We invite you, as always, to be part of the program. It's so simple. Give us a call and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. If you're not into the phone, no problem. Get to us by chat room. Simon Apple 04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the phone is on the air, you can connect to others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk or Spreaker screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Hugo Glick from Black Earth Rising on Netflix will join us live here in New York after these news notes. New ventures out to create more television programming keep coming from all corners. Enter Shopify, the fast-growing web retail destination. Their effort is Shopify Studios, out to develop, finance, and co-produce content for a variety of networks. At first, Shopify will work with Mr. Robot Producers Anonymous Content, Wheelhouse Entertainment's Spoke Studios division, and Seville Productions. Shopify expects to announce its first TV efforts under its studios unit in the near future. If you want Hulu as a 60-channel bundle, you'll have to pay $5 more a month as of today. That's up from $40 per month before. However, Hulu's ad-supported format of movies and series, originals like The Handmaid's Tale included, will now cost $2 less a month to $6 a month. Every price remains at $12 a month. Kate Winslet is set to make her HBO miniseries return. She will headline Mare of Easttown, a detective saga set in rural Pennsylvania. Winslet won an Emmy for playing the title role in her first HBO undertaking, Mildred Pierce, based on the famous Joan Crawford movie and best-selling book of the 1940s, in 2011. Long-running legal drama Suits will call it a run on USA later this year. A 10-episode final season has been greenlit by USA, hours before beginning the second half of Season 8 tonight. And mark April 9th as the start date for Bobby Vernon. That's FX's scripted miniseries based on the relationship between Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon. And that is news notes for today. We have a roundabout way of getting to our first subject today. We got it because of an interview that we did last fall with the co-star, former co-star of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, the wonderful Tamara Tooney. And during that conversation, which many of you enjoyed, I might add, Tooney told us about a program that she was involved with that already made its debut on the BBC and will be coming to Netflix this month. Well, that miniseries is coming on Netflix Friday. It's called Black Earth Rising. It deals with a very tough topic. And the person behind it has dealt with a lot of interesting issues over the course of his career. 5 years ago, he won the Peabody Award for The Honorable Woman, the critically acclaimed miniseries on Stars starring Maggie Gyllenhaal. Joining me here in New York in an interview exclusive, writer-director of Black Earth Rising, Hugo Glick. Hugo, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Probably the toughest scripted assignment down anyone's pipe is to touch upon a mass tragedy, whether it is the Holocaust or Jonestown, or in this case, the genocide situation in Rwanda. Why is this having taken on?
I guess, you know, in this time in our world, where in the U.S. and in maybe in the U.K. as well, we're becoming increasingly turning our backs against the outside world. We're literally interested in building walls to shield us from the outside. But the truth of the matter is no matter how tall or firm a wall is, or if we in the UK want to get into Brexit and withdraw from Europe, etc., the outside just doesn't go away. It's always going to be there, and our responsibilities to that outside world will remain. Now, you know, it's true to say when we look back on that genocide in 1994, during the time it was happening, incidentally, the only thing I think we were really aware of right in the middle of that period was a white Bronco going down an L.A. freeway with O.J. Simpson inside it. But then we found out a little bit later that at exactly the same time, tragic as O.J. Simpson's private story was, up to 1 million people were being systematically slaughtered in Rwanda during the genocide. And Bill Clinton at the time, in fairness, held his hand up and went, oh, my God, we didn't see this. We didn't look. So I guess these days when we are turning away from the things, as I've said before, it's important just to take a moment to remember that we are connected to this situation. We are all connected to the same world. If you were an astronaut, for example, and you were sitting up in a space station and you look down, in 1 minute you might see the U.S. 40 minutes later, you'll see Africa. We're all the same, and we need to pay attention.
How long did it take for you to develop the way to tell this story? Because this story is being told by and about someone who lived through this genocide, was orphaned by it, and she is out to not only sort of understand why this happened, but maybe to get at the truth of how to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, well, to make such a sort of, you know, there you are, you just heard me make a great big mission statement, literally invoking a space station about what this is all about. But the only reason it actually means anything to us in terms of fiction and creative drama, story is driven by an individual. And the only way that an individual may become a bit more universal than the specifics of that story is if she has an identity crisis. She doesn't know where she comes from. She doesn't know her past. And in a strange way, she's a detective to find out about herself and take herself back to the past to create a fuller personality. I mean, there's a famous quote from William Faulkner that says the past is never dead, not even past. And I'll be honest with you, I have no idea what that meant at the time. But looking into it, I think it's a profound meaning, which is if you can face the future sort of fully equipped, you have to know everything about your past. So if you don't know your past, you have to go back and collect it. And having done so, you're properly armored to turn around and be in the present and face whatever the future brings. And that's what this character has to do. She has to go back to her past, the mystery of it, find out who she is so she's better prepared for the future. And I guess that's sort of what we all do in our lives. So hopefully it has a universality to it so that you want to take that journey with her.
That journey and the character who takes that journey is Kate Ashby. She is played by a very striking actress. I've never heard of her before. Her name is Michaela Coel. But I have a hunch that once they see this woman, they are going to be mesmerized by her. I've seen some clips of her performance, and I have a strong hunch this may be an Emmy Award winner for best miniseries category this fall.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, let's hope for it. It's true, because it's a remarkable performance. Some of your listeners may be aware of her work in a thing called Chewing Gum, which is a comedy that has aired and does air on Netflix. It was a UK-based urban comedy. It was much admired by the small audience that took it to its heart. But this is, it's true, a big step forward for her on a more international platform. And I think she more than holds her own with John Goodman, who's her co-star. And she has a huge cinematic charisma. She has that kind of rare ability of a woman of such youth to have a huge amount of energy in her spirit, but a great stillness on screen. And that's a rarity, and I think it's hopefully it will be celebrated. It deserves to be.
Where does she come from, Hugo? And is there anything that she could relate to, whether or not she herself experienced what Kat experienced?
It was very, you're right. It was very interesting. It was a very difficult role to cast. A young woman with a deep, deep trauma in her past that she didn't know about, as I've described. Therefore, difficult to find out a performance that was going to be able to inhabit this. And I was struggling, frankly. And one evening I was sitting down watching TV with my wife, and I saw this woman being interviewed for this thing called Chewing Gum at an award ceremony, a local show. And I turned to my wife and said, my God, that's her. This is my Kate Ashby. She looks and has all the attributes that I was looking for. And it turned out she did, because she, being of African descent, also had, she's Ghanaian, although she's a UK national, and came here when she was young with her mother to the UK, and she had not been back to Ghana. And strangely, that's where we went to film this project, even though it was set in Rwanda, for reasons of many reasons, political sensitivities. We had to film it in Ghana, which is in the same sort of geographical belt of Africa, but it afforded Michaela the opportunity to return to her roots, to discover who she was as a person. And it did inform her portrayal of the character.
Black Earth Rising is Netflix's new miniseries. It's a co-production with the BBC, which presented the series last fall to rave reviews. We're speaking with the Peabody Award-winning writer-director of this project, Hugo Blix. He won that award several years ago for doing The Honorable Woman on Stars with a fine performance by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's now seen, by the way, in the HBO series The Deuce, now in its third and final season. Hugo joins me here in New York. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. Simon Appleman with you live from New York. Delighted to have you with us on our special Wednesday edition, second of three shows we're doing this week. And if you have a question or a comment for Hugo, bring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. One more episode this week coming your way on Friday, and we got a dandy for you. First up, someone we've wanted to have in this program for a very long time. From one of the most popular shows on TV, The Voice on NBC, executive producer Audrey Morrissey. And then we'll meet former writer, producer on Frasier, Mark Reisman. He's doing his first original family comedy this Friday for the Disney Channel. It's called Sydney to the Max, and we'll hear all about it. That's all coming up Friday, 3:30 Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow will be televised. You also have, as I mentioned earlier, Tamara Tooney from Law & Order Special Victims Unit, best known for that series, and also John Goodman. And both of them play very interesting roles in your program.
Absolutely. I mean, starting with John, I'm such a huge fan of John Goodman's, because he plays in this production an international legal lawyer. It's a very calm, it's a considered role. It's very unusual. You won't expect to see John in this role. But what he brought to it, his performance, I think it's because he has a comedic sensibility. He has a kind of jazz performance style, which is to say that he moves across the script that he has and he's obviously performing in a way that's kind of unexpected and never the same twice. And as he does it, he fabrics a role that, when I went into the edit, it's a 3-month shoot for him, so you never kind of see the whole performance, obviously. When I went into the edit and saw that as it sort of ran out, I couldn't believe how precise John had been in the construction of his character and how incredibly moving and humane he is, which, might be a surprise for those who've seen In the Conners or The Great Lebowski. He is a delicate, delicate performer, and I was honored to work with him. Likewise with Tamara. Tamara just has a great sense of comedy. I think for the sort of kind of heavy heft of our story, I was really keen to have people accompany me on the journey who had a lightness of touch in their performances. And Tamara gave just that. She was incredibly funny, both on and off set. So, I couldn't have been luckier with my Cleveland cast. It was, it made a very difficult show in some ways because of the subject matter, a delight to make. And I hope also it will be a real engaging watch for those that trouble to take the journey with us.
How does the way you moved in this program as a writer director differ from the style you did for The Honorable Woman?
Not at all. It's very similar. I have a kind of quite light touch relationship with all of my cast and crew, particularly with my cast. Casting is like 90% of, you know, the importance of a director's job is to get the casting right. And I took quite a lot of time to sort of calibrate on who might be right. And so, you know, when Maggie and I sort of decided we both, you know, did our dance together to see that we wanted to work together, once we decided, I kind of let the performance go where it wants. I am just there once I trust the performance to be go where it wants, to display the character as it wants. And that's what Maggie did with such beauty with that Golden Globe winning role. I was there to witness her do what she did in the increment of every scene. And I just trusted her to deliver the dexterity role she did. It's a remarkable performance. And I feel the same about the performances that we're seeing or about to see in Black Earth Rising.
Your project is structured very much like a thriller. And it seems that British television has got a great way of dealing with that kind of television, going all the way back to series like The Saint and Danger Man and Secret Agent and others that seem to have a really good knack for how to do that kind of television. For you, as both writer and director, what's the secret to making a good thriller, particularly a thriller that deals with a situation like genocide?
Well, when you use the word genocide, it's very difficult to just sort of slightly take a step away and then talk to you about the craft and technique, but I'll do so. So if we set the subject matter to one side, which is so huge and tragic, but if you then look at the techniques of it, and it is something, you're right, that's kind of peculiarly British. There's something about the spy that's in every Brit, really. It's why that you think of Le Carrier and other great spy novelists. There's something cloak and dagger about the way in which the Brits operate in their world. They do it very effectively in the real world. And in fiction, it's a kind of disguise and feint. You try and make the audience think that the story is going in one direction, and then you literally or metaphorically whack them from the dark side in a place they weren't looking, with a story beat or a narrative a reversal that the audience weren't expecting. It's a little bit like magic. It's a little bit like the tricks of being a magician. And it seems to be something in the British sensibility that we do it pretty well. I mean, does it make us untrustworthy, political untrustworthy people? I don't know. I think we use it for a sense of ultimate fair play. So stories like Black Earth Rising, The Honorable Woman, and others, like even The Night Manager that comes through from Le Carrier, they're all about exploring a world that's out of whack and needs to be repositioned. And I think both the UK as real political players and as craft people of creative drama do something of that. And I guess that's what gives us that kind of edge, or at least that unusualness.
Something else too, Hugo, is that a lot of times in these British thrillers, a lot of the characters are very soft-spoken. I often think about Alec Guinness, the great actor, and how he played George Smiley in Secret Shadow Soldier Spy and Spy People, two miniseries that were presented here in the United States through Operation Primetime, independent syndication series for miniseries for many years for TV stations. It just seems that the characters, rather than speak in like very pronounced tones, they're like always soft-spoken so that you never know when they're going to turn on you with some sort of action.
It's true. I mean, Alec was the prime exponent. There's a scene in Tinker Tailor where Alec, having done exactly as you say, he's whispered his way through the opening episode. He finds a mole, which is a kind of a busted spy in the center of his circus, which is his unit, and they pull this guy in, and the guy sort of is stuck in front of this, essentially looks like your granddad, played by Alec Guinness, who then wanders in, having been incredibly soft-spoken and done as well, sits in front of this disheveled individual, and then simply places a very heavily specked piece of bifocal spectacles onto his nose and lifts his eyes, which are suddenly penetratively drawn by the thickness of those lenses, and says, "So, tell me everything." And when he says that at the end, which finishes the episode, you suddenly realize that this gentleman is an absolute killer and will cut you out dead as you know, before you know, if you raise his anger. And you couldn't believe it. It's like an uncle who just suddenly whips out a switchblade and has it at your throat before you even knew. And something about the British sensibility and that kind of politeness disguises that savagery. And it makes it a pretty compelling viewing.
Black Earth Rising, if you have a smart TV set or smart TV device, chances are you can catch it starting Friday on Netflix. We've got Hugo Blick, the Peabody-winning writer-producer behind this unique, important miniseries right here on Tomorrow Be Televised this half hour. Simon Applebaum with you live with him from New York. If you have a question or comment, make the phone call now, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up next Friday on the program, among our guests, we'll have Devin Gregory. He is the creator and showrunner of BET's new series about the making of Soul Train, American Soul, premieres next month. Devin Gregory, a week from Friday, right here exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. When Tomorrow was on the program, one thing that caught my attention from what you said is that you use animated sequences in this program. Is that the case? And how do you use animation to sort of further the storyline?
Exactly. Well, that was the sensitivity to the subject matter, because the animation, when it's used, is used directly to depict aspects of the genocide that occurred during the 1994 genocide of Rwanda. And I felt that really there were two brutal truths about it. One, with Hotel Rwanda and other stories, a film with Idris Elba, we have seen in live action the depiction of the process of the genocide and up to it. And perhaps if I did that again, the audience would almost switch off because they felt they might have seen it in a dreadful way. But also, more importantly and profoundly, I felt it was a subject that couldn't be, a little bit like the sun, it couldn't be directly stared at. It seemed to me almost insensitive, impolite, wrong, immoral maybe. And so I felt that the way around that was to depict these events with a kind of elliptical animation style that just drew you in almost like poetry into perhaps what happened in certain instances that we needed to know. And I felt that it was a very moving, evocative way, an unusual way to engage the audience in something they feel they might already know. But when they see it like this, it's presented in a way they've never seen it before. And I hope it would make them re-engage in issues for which we all should really be aware of and reminded about.
You mentioned at the start, Hugo, that you wanted the audience to not turn their back on what we could learn from a situation like this. You've had a couple of months now to gauge the reaction in England to the series because it came on the BBC first. Has that mission been fulfilled from what you've heard from the audience?
Well, I tell you what, I mean, there's two sides to this. When you take on a kind of overt political story as this is, I don't think it is the creators' expectation or arrogance think that they can ever move the needle on the vinyl record forward because of their involvement in the story. I just don't think that that's right. That said, I think all art is political, really. I mean, very famous people have said that before, and it's true. So all I hope you can do, and I think it happened in the UK, and I hope it will happen more in the US, actually, because of our involvement, or perhaps lack of involvement politically during the genocide, is it just reminds folk that there is a needle, and it's there. And the story may not shift it backwards or forwards, but I hope it will just remind people that the needle exists. And we do have a responsibility. I mean, if you take, for example, the Central African state of Rwanda, which does have problems, political problems, and as an echo and aftermath and legacy of the genocide, now a quarter of a century later, it takes in up to 33% of its GDP comes from foreign sources. That's us, you know? And if our economy contracted by 33% because we took ourselves out of that story, it would decimate that economy. So we really are involved. We are participants. And part of that story that we discover, and people might think it's familiar, but there's a trail of conflict, coltan, which is a mineral that goes into your phones. It probably goes into your Teslas if you're lucky enough to have one. So therefore, we think we're being really green, perhaps with the Tesla, but actually, where is it coming from? It's coming from sometimes quite conflicted environments which really don't have all the kind of rubber stamp of correctness that we might wish and expect. And so we do have a responsibility to engage with that story, partly because we're at the other end of the supply line, and everything is international, whether we want it or not. And that's what the story kind of wants to engage in, through the prism, I might say, of very personal, engaging, and engaged dramatic storytelling.
Unique, thrilling, and hopefully groundbreaking too. Black Earth Rising is Netflix's latest miniseries, and it premieres this Friday. If you have a smart television instead of a smart TV device, you can find it out for yourself. And if you want more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.netflix.com. That's www.netflix.com, Black Earth Rising, with Michaela Coel, John Goodman, and Tamara Tierney headlining a really extraordinary cast. Hugo Glick, writer director of Black Earth Rising, thank you so much for joining us here in New York. All the very best with this series. I have a hunch that this fall at Emmy time and next year at Peabody time, we're going to hear a lot about your series and the great stuff it's done.
You're very kind. Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome, Hugo. All the greatest. Take care.
And you. Bye now.
Hugo Glick from Black Earth Rising, joining us live from New York. More tomorrow with Televised coming your way, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. Have you heard? When you try out Audible.com for a month, you get more for your money now and more for your trial. Think about this. Used to be just one audiobook. Now you get three. One from the great catalog of over 180,000 titles to choose from in every category under the sun. And now two from the growing catalog of Audible Originals, original audio programming made especially for this service. It's everything from one-woman and one-man shows. It's off-Broadway and Broadway material, regional theater too, and original productions especially for this service. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/televised. It's audibletrial.com/televised. And don't forget, you can listen to all of Audible's great programming on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or iHeartRadio. All you got to do is sign up for a one-month trial, three free audiobooks, one regular, two Audible Originals. And by the way, if you decide to turn your trial into a subscription, you get your choice of three audiobooks every single month. Same thing, one regular, two Audible Originals. So remember, audibletrial.com/televised, audibletrial.com/televised, and hear for yourself how audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. Audible.com, an Amazon company. This is Tomorrow We Televised. We are the program all about the tube. Great to have you with us on this midweek afternoon. 42 degrees at the top of the Apple. Let's get near 50, by the way. Maybe even break 50 here in the Big Apple tomorrow. Don't forget, coming up on our program Friday, our third of three episodes this week, we'll bring you Audrey Morrissey, the executive producer of one of the most popular shows anywhere on television, The Voice on NBC. And also, we'll have former Frasier writer-producer Mark Reefman. He's got a brand new Disney Channel comedy he's doing and premieres Friday called Sydney to the Max. And don't forget, 1 week from Friday, among our guests is David Gregory. He's the creator and showrunner of American Soul, BET's first original scripted series of the year, and one that's long anticipated, with a terrific cast dealing with the star of Soul Train and how Don Cornelius became a sensational entrepreneur from it. By the way, when we have Devin on, I'm going to tell you about a story about a conversation I had with another Don Cornelius that came out of the blue, and it turned out to be very, very special. And we'll talk to Devin about that conversation too. So be with us. That's a week from Friday. We'll kick off February with that and more right here on Tomorrow We Televised. When we come back, The Joker's Wild is back tonight with Snoop Dogg as the host for a brand new network. Not just TBS, TNT. Executive producer Vince Rubino, who also works for $100,000 Pyramid on ABC, will join me here in the Big Apple after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com and www.spreaker.com. Together, they reach more than 30 million listeners around the world every month and growing. BTR is your home for The Walk, a very unusual exercise in radio. Check it out every week, various times, The Walk. It's unforgettable, and you can catch it exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Marvy Televised, and we're happy to have you with us for the second part of our 90-minute edition. And we have a great guest coming your way this half hour and the next as well. So give us a call. Be part of the program, 646-652-2906, or you can use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You can hear it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. When it comes to long-running game shows, one of the most unique that's had more lives than maybe a cat is The Joker's Wild. Created by Jack Barry in 1972, it first ran for three seasons on CBS. Then it had a big syndicated run for nearly a decade, hosted by Barry and later by Bill Collins. And then there was the 1990 version hosted by Pat Finn, who later went on to Shock to Drop. And for the last 3 years, it has been the purveyance of Snoop Dogg. The first two seasons were on TBS in prime time. Tonight, it's back with the dog, but this time it's on two networks, TNT first at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, and then the following night on TBS. Joining us live for an interview exclusive from New York, one of the executive producers of both The Joker's Wild and The $100,000 Pyramid, coming back for season four with Michael Strahan as the host later this year on ABC. Great to have back on the program, Vincent Rubino. Hi, Vincent.
Hey, Stuart. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you.
Sorry,
what's
Simon.
That's okay. So, Ben, what's it been like to get Snoop back for his third go-round on The Joker's Wild?
Well, I'll tell you something. Snoop has a great sort of a demeanor about the world and how he works. And everybody thinks Snoop's sort of like just kind of moseying along. He's one of the hardest working guys in showbiz. And we actually shot these shows 20 shows in a row with him in 5 days. He has more energy than any person I've ever worked with, and he was an absolute pro. And not that I was surprised by it, but he really comes to work, and he knows his gear, he knows what he needs to do, and the show's a lot of fun to make, and he makes it fun to do. We shot in Los Angeles, and I believe We had set the schedule, the shoot schedule, and I got a call from his management team and said, oh, you know, the first day of shooting is the day after the Oscars. And I said, yeah, I know. What's that mean? He said, well, Snoop likes to go to the parties the night of the Oscars. I'm like, okay, but we have 5 shows scheduled to shoot on Monday. They're like, do you want to move it around? I said, I can't move it now. And I said, what time do the parties end? They said, well, they started around 2 in the morning. I said, well, maybe he just doesn't go to the parties. And they said, that's not going to happen. The next morning, Monday morning, at about 7:30, I got a call from the guard shack at Sony Studios. Snoop was there and ready to go at 7:30 in the morning. And I came to the studio and said, you're about 2 hours early. He goes, I'm here. Let's do it. And he literally was up and running 5 shows in one day, and it was like he hadn't been out all night. He's sort of an amazing guy and really a born comedian and host, that's for sure. Does that answer your question? What's that?
And how has he evolved as a host? Because it seems to me from the first season to the second season, it seemed he took more control of the show. He was more relaxed. He was more two-way with the contestants. I also liked the way the final round, the Beat the Devil round went, where at some point, all right, you've reached a certain point. How about let me sweeten the pot and see if you'd like to bow out now with these $1,000 rather than go for $50,000 or hit the devil?
Well, it's funny because in the first season when we met and he said to me, I don't like to rehearse a lot. And I said to him, I completely understand that. Now, I'm used to working with hosts that will wear an earpiece, an IFB, so I can talk to them while they're not talking, so I can give them direction. And I quickly understood that he would not do that, and I understand why, because he's a performer. He needs to listen to everything that's going on, and he's going to take it the way he wants to go. So I said to him, look, Snoop, if you can just rehearse and what I want you to do is learn the structure of the show so that at that point, then you know where you are at all times in the show, then it's yours to run with. I won't need to stop down and talk to you. I don't like to stop a show because it sort of takes the air out of the room when you do that. And so for the first season, he was literally, he was on his own, but I would stop down and talk to him in between things. He wasn't wearing an earpiece, but he was getting his groove, understanding the beats of the show, so that by season two, now he knew every beat where all the moments were to play, and he's a very affable sort of avuncular guy, and he connects with those contestants and the audience. He's an MC. That's what he does for a living. So he knows how to run a room, and he just gets better and better at it, and he's naturally funny. And the final round that you talk about, we changed that in the second season because it felt like, you know, it was just them pulling the lever and spinning the wheels and deciding whether to go or not. And it kind of moves so quickly. And Snoop loves to see people win money. So he just keep egging them on. And I felt like he needed something else to do. And I said to him, what do you think if we gave you a big box of money and you could at certain points give them some decision points, try and make, you know, entice them a little bit? He goes, that's what I do, man. I'm a dealer. Give me the money. I'll handle it. And as sure as hell, as long as I told him you can only give away this much, he knew, and he would just – I didn't – like I said, I don't talk to him on an earpiece. So he would literally just go on his own, and he knows what how much money to give them and sort of entice them along and make the game that much more interesting. And it worked actually flawlessly. And I was really, really thrilled with it because – sometimes you don't know how that's going to play. But with a guy like that, he listens intently to what's going on, and he certainly understands money and how to play with it. And that's all you want him to do on this show. And it played out quite beautifully on 20 episodes in 5 days, no less.
One of the most interesting things and one of the charms about Joker's Wild, this new version, is how it's funky, but yet there is so much of the classic Joe the way that Jack Barry designed it, where you have the categories, where you have Joker, 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 where you have, but yet the categories are funky. They often have videos, and there's still a root of, there's general knowledge you still have to get in order to, play.
Right. Well, it's funny, when years ago, Sony had sent me a bunch of formats from their library and said, what do you think of, in particular, Joker's Wild? And I looked at it and I said, it's a good format. It's old. It needs to clearly be updated. But I don't think it's really going to fly unless you get the right host for it. So we passed on that when I'm working on Pyramid. But then I got a call from a woman named Constance Schwartz-Marini, who used to be Snoop's manager. She's now Michael Strahan's business partner. She and I have become very good friends after Pyramid. And she said to me, you know, Snoop wants to host a game show. I was like, are you kidding me? That would be great. I'd love to talk to you about it. So she puts me on the phone with him. He calls me one day in my house, and my son was in the living room. I said, Jack, it's Snoop on the phone. He's like, really? So I started talking to him, and he said he wanted to do this game show. I said, so Snoop, I love the idea that you wanted to host a game show. I think you'd be perfect at it. Let me go and see what formats are available, and I'll get the rights to them. And he said, don't even bother. I said, why? He goes, I only want to do one show. I said, what show is that? He says, Joker's Wild. I'm like, really? Why that show? He said, when I was growing up, I would come home from school. My mom was working, and my grandmother was there. And every afternoon from 3 to 4, we would sit there and play Joker's Wild. He goes, and I loved that show. I loved everything about it. He goes, and now I'm a celebrity. I could be the guy who's at the podium and giving away all that money and getting those people to win. He goes, let's do it. I'm ready to do this. And I got to tell you, the minute I got together a bunch of writers in New York, it was so easy and fun to write for him, because if you rewrote the show entirely around him, not that you have to know anything about Snoop, but we could do things like categories like Compton or Connecticut. We'd ask, and they're funny. They're very sort of zeitgeisty and in the moment. And you don't have to know a lot of things, but it's pretty much general knowledge. And anybody who writes to the show really loves it, because he's not your typical game show host. He will perform things. He won't perform everything, but things that make sense. We have categories called Dumped by the Dog, where we put on this mood lighting. It's kind of a 70s cheesy vibe, and he like talks to this girl, an imaginal girl, it's an actress, and you got to guess who he's dumping, and the audience loves it. We do these preacher bits where he gets up and preaches something, and the audience has to, the contestant has to guess what he's preaching about. Stuff like Nostradamus, like some of the favorite, you can't write that for other shows, and it's very unique to him. And like I said to him, we're building the stage, and we blew up the show because Joker's Wild is a great format. It's a very simple format, and it was very old the way it was set originally. So what we decided to do is make that slot machine the centerpiece of the show. So it's now you're in Snoop Dogg's casino, and he loved that idea. And that's what he said, I'm wearing a tuxedo. I'm going to wear a red velvet tuxedo every night because he wants to be the MC. And I'm telling you, he knows where his strengths are, and he can run with it. It's one of my favorite shows to work on, and I actually can't wait to do it again. And this season, we had at least five winners or so, five or six winners, and you never know. And even when people lose, they walk away just happy to have met Snoop. That's all they ever say, just happy to be here. And it's the greatest thing. He cuts across a lot of demographics, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Snoop Dogg presents The Joker's Wild, goes into Season 3 tonight. Now, remember, it's not on TBS. The start is on TNT. That's right. I think it's TNT's first time of the game show, by the way. It's on 10:30. It's right after Drop the Mic, James Corden's show, which will also start its third season tonight at 10 Eastern. So it's Drop the Mic, followed by Joker's Wild on TNT. And then the next night, Thursday, it's on the same time period on TBS. Vince Rubino is the executive producer on Joker's Wild and also on The $100,000 Pier. We'll talk about that in a little bit. If you have a question or a comment for Vin, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Any interesting changes in terms of new categories or other things this year with the format?
The only change is you try and repeat some categories that are favorites for people. At Go Deep Dog is one where he talks about something like a sort of a Barry White thing. There's always some category or two that relates to weed. There's one called Bon Voyage. And the difference in it from season to season is usually both the contestants and the celebrity roll-ins. And because Snoop is who he is, it's a very easy phone call to make. You call these celebrities and they'd love to do it. Really happy to get it. And all they got to do is come to a green screen stage and read a bunch of questions. And they're always things that are funny, make them look good and funny. I think we did something with Ice Cube. I think it's called I'm Hangry or something like that. And Ice Cube's rapping about how hungry he is, and you got to guess what he's trying to eat. And it's that kind of stuff that makes the show different from season to season. It's who will get involved. There's another one with Pug Life. We did something about there's a pug on the internet. I forget his name, but it's all questions about Doug the Pug. And that's so unique to this show, and it's what makes it – it's a comedic game show where people win money. And it's very, very easy to produce just because Snoop takes it and runs with it. He can make anything funny, and he has spectacular timing, which is all you want in a host, you know.
What's it like, Ben, to do not just Joker's Wild, but Pyramid in a similar situation where you have a Snoop Dogg and a Michael Strahan, both who have come from different backgrounds, who have now learned to run the ball as mm-hmm. opposed to the show? And in case of Michael, also be behind the scenes, too.
Well, I'll tell you, the thing about those guys, both of them are, they're incredible professionals, like to a T. Snoop, I think Snoop maybe sleeps 5 hours a night. He's constantly working on something. In fact, when he wanted to condense the schedule, and I said, well, Snoop, why would you want to do it over 1 week as opposed to two? And he said some kind of a rhyme. It said something like, what's red, what's blue? I got other customers standing right behind you. Because he's constantly working. And so that's all you want is a host that is invested and wants to work. Michael Strahan, probably twice as driven. He's a professional football player. He understood that this was something he had never done, but he said to me, look, I'm the player, you're the coach. You know this world. Just show me what I got to do. And I said, Michael, as long as you want to give me a month of rehearsals, I'll take you through it. You need to know this show and the format like the back of your hand, and then it's yours to run with, because think of this as a party you're hosting in your living room. The studio is your living room, and it's going out to all of America, but these celebrities, they're all your friends, and that's the way you got to do it. As long as you know the game, you can do whatever you need to do. And he was there every day for a month. Right after Good Morning America, we rehearsed. We set it up in a little space where we had all computers and we brought in contestants. And he wanted to know all the finer points. And as soon as he walked out there, it was like he had hosted it forever. And that's, you can't ask for more from a host. You know, I've worked with people before who, you know, they sort of just dial it in. But these guys are literally, they just want to perfect it. And when you're doing a show, like the reason these shows like Pyramid and Joker's Wild come back is because they were perfected on the air. They went on the air when there were only three channels. So they may not have gone on as perfect formats, but over the years, they've become completely honed down and perfect. You don't want to mess with them. All you want to do is modernize them and make them as relevant in terms of the game material and the hosts and the celebrities. And these guys both smack of just modern elegance because they really do handle themselves like true entertainers. And that's all you can, because really the star of the show is the game itself, but they just add so much color to it. And that's what's, you know, fun about it. And Strahan, I've learned so much from both of them because they are so hardworking, and you're surprised by that sometimes, because usually you think people may make a lot of money. They just go off and do what they want to do. These guys are working 24/7, it seems, especially Strahan. He's got probably 7 jobs, you know?
The thing about Pyramid, and I've been a fan of Pyramid all along, and it was my pleasure to have one of my first interviews covering television with Bob Stewart, the man who created Pyramid. And I think next to Mark Goodson, Dick Vitale, I think the great game show person. He created Password. He was one of the original producers on To Tell the Truth, on The Price is Right.
Price is Right. Yep.
Just created Pyramid, created so many other shows, Jackpot, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is that, as you said, the game wasn't messed with in this revival. The set is bright. You have the categories. You have the great byplay. I think Rich DePiro's done a wonderful job doing what Mike Avio did in the original direction, which is the focus on the two-shot. And then, of course, the winner's circle with that three is still the best 60 seconds of a bonus round you will ever see on television. You
absolutely
watch
right.
That round, and you are like, say this, you know, say this, say that, you know, to get the money.
And that's the brilliance of that. The entire show, every 30 seconds, those 30-second bits where the contestant is trying to get the celebrity to guess things, it's all this like compressed energy, and it explodes at 30 seconds if they get it right. And you're right, and it all builds to that final round. One of the key things when I talked to Sony about this, I had to go in and present what my vision was to take, you know, to bring Pyramid into the modern era. And I said, I would be a fool if I came in here and said, I want to rearrange the entire format, because this thing, the reason you're asking me to bring it back is because everybody remembers it. It's because it's a great format. So what I would do, and I said to them, what anybody loves about a game show, especially when I was a kid, you love things that are moving on the set. Because I've often thought about game shows as you're sort of inside of a slot machine or a pinball machine as a human being in this giant oversized pinball machine. And on Pyramid, what I loved about it was the way those squares used to turn. And there were physical guys, two guys back there with gloves on in the old days, slapping those things around, and there were cards inside them. You know, they were like what they call them, trilons. And I said to Sony, the only way to do the show right is to build that pyramid with trilons, but make them now giant flat screens, but they're all on wheels and spin around. Well, we had to go and design it. We went to this place called Shulman in New York, and the guys built these brilliant, it's an amazing machine. They've talked about moving the show to Los Angeles, but I don't want to do that primarily because I'm afraid of moving that machine. It's very sensitive. It's all these like wheels and bushings and screws and tension screws that, because I still have two guys that are back there that listen on headsets and they watch lights that flash and they move them by themselves by hand because they're big. And when they settle, they land and rock a little bit. And there was talk about getting machines to do it. Machines, first of all, are really loud. Two, they break down, and a man listens to what's being played and moves it. And there's something about that I love. It's very elegant and it's tactile. Don't forget, we're watching television now. Everybody's watching on flat screens at home, and what's on stage can't be on flat screens. It's got to have some depth to it, and we kept it that way, and I think that's what people respond to. It's not your father's pyramid, but it's the same game modernized, and thankfully the audience likes it, and we're in season 4, knock on wood. And with that combination of a great show like that and a great host like Strahan, you know, that's why it's doing well, and good writing.
By the way, I want to give credit then to the person who created the design, the original design for Pyramid, a man named Jim Ryan, R-Y-A-N, who created the original design for Pyramid when it was first on CBS and ABC. And I'm thrilled, by the way, about two things. One, that the show is in New York, because that's where the show really took off, was in New York with Dick Clark as the host. And they had that great audience reaction. And the other thing, too, was Stewart was a master at pairing celebrities with contestants. He wanted celebrities who really knew how to play the game. And to your credit and everybody else's credit on the show, you've done that. A lot of the celebrities who are on the program albeit the new generation of celebrities,
yeah,
as opposed to the first generation where you have people like William Shatner and Dick Cavett and Tony Randall, all very erudite people. But
right,
somebody playing the game in New York, this new group really can work with the contestants. And it's also interesting, too, is that in the winner's circle, the contestants are giving the clues, as opposed to the original format,
right,
where it was the celebrities. And then for a while it was pick and choose. But now, in your version, it's the contestants giving the clues. And it's really amazing how good they are with the clues.
Well, and look, the reason, Simon, I made that decision primarily because back in the day with Bob Stewart, when he was doing it, he would actually audition celebrities. And if they weren't good in the game, more than likely, he just wouldn't have them on because they were doing five of them a day. And also, when you're doing a game that you do five of them in one day as a player, you get better and better at it. For ABC, these people are coming in for one show. And it's kind of tough because once they get in there and start playing, they're like, oh, after it's over, they're like, oh, now I get it. So we can't really audition celebrities. If they say yes, they're coming on. So in order to take the pressure off the celebrity, because they feel horrible when the contestant doesn't win money and they feel responsible. So, and a lot of times in the winner's circle, because the rules are what they are, a lot of times somebody will make a mistake and say something and right away they've lost the money, at least the big money. And in order to keep the celebrity, the onus on the contestant, we've told the celebrity, believe me, it's in your best interest to be a guesser in the winner's circle. Let the contestant be the person that's giving you clues, because ostensibly they've been spending the last 2 months practicing and studying the rules. Unlike you, a celebrity who has other jobs, this is just another day in your life. You're going to prepare for it, but you're not going to know the rules as well as they are. And it's better that you guess. You're only as good as the guess, as the clues they give you, your guesses. And so it's worked out quite well for us in that regard. No celebrities have insisted on giving clues, just because it winds up, you know, if they say one word wrong, it's an illegal clue, they've lost the big money. And that's been a good thing. And I'll tell you, Bob Stewart was a genius. His son Sandy is a very good friend of mine. Sandy consulted with me on this first season of Pyramid. And I said to him, Sandy, I have great love for these formats. I want to honor it, but I want to make sure that we further it. And he was thrilled with it. I have great respect for what Sandy and his father did. You know, his father created Price is Right. Do you know that story of how he created Price is Right? He was working for Goodson Todman in Midtown, and he had just moved out of an apartment and had all of his old clothes and threw them in the garbage as he went into the office at Rockefeller Center. It was the middle of the winter, I think. And by the time he came out of work at 7 o'clock at night, somebody had fished out of the garbage all of his clothes, and they were hanging them on these posts on the street and selling them, auctioning them off. And he said to himself, that's a great idea for a TV show. I'm going to call it The Auctioneer. And he went back in the office, and he developed The Price is Right. That's, to me, like, that's brilliant 1950s, 60s television creation, you know?
Yeah, and by the way, many of the Price is Right episodes, both daytime and primetime, on NBC and ABC are now on YouTube. Check them out. And you will see some of the prizes they offered on that show were unbelievable for a primetime show at that time. And Bill Cullen, who I wish would please somebody give him an honorary Emmy Award posthumously, did a fantastic job of that show. He was amazing.
He was a staple of game shows, very likable, and he connected. There was something, it's funny, a guy with like big, thick glasses, but he was just so warm and everybody loved him. I watched Drew Carey the other day. Drew Carey does an amazing job on Price is Right. He's really made it his own, and he's really great at it, I think.
I agree, and he's really great. He's really come to really be great with the contestants. And I have to give credit to Mike Richards, the executive producer. We've had the show a number of times, and his staff are really, really adding a lot of things to Price is Right over the last decade of Drew's work that has really made it good. They did more relationship with the models, really giving them more personality, giving them more of the shine of their personality and what they do, and some of the games that they come up with are really terrific.
Oh, I think so too. They really moved the ball forward. And just to jump back on Pyramid and Joker's Wild, if I would be remiss if I didn't mention Rich DePiro, who's a brilliant director and who actually loves these games as much as I do and you do, and that's why they look the way they do. And my head writer, David Levinson-Wilk, is probably one of the smartest guys I know. He's responsible for the tone of those questions, and that, to me, is how you modernize these things. If they're in a modern vernacular and everybody gets it, there's always a wink to them, and that's what makes these shows resonate, I think, because they're a great format, too, you know? fun
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, same
you know?
Here. But one of these days, we got to get Rich on because Rich has done some wonderful work on everything from Whammy, the Pressure Luck Revival with Todd Newton. He did Prices Right. He did Deal No Deal for many years.
Yep.
He's a terrific. He's, I think, one of the best game show directors right now, and I'd love to have him
he
on.
He is. He is. I'll tell him that. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of these forms, these formats, and how to shoot them. And that's I wouldn't make another game show without him, quite frankly.
Absolutely. We're going to take a call. Hello, you're on Tomorrow Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, Simon. It's Rick Webb calling from Philadelphia.
Good to hear you after a long time. Happy New Year to you and everybody down there. And you're on the line with Vince Urbino. Go ahead.
Well, first I wanted to say happy birthday to Simon. Happy birthday. Congratulations on another successful year of your show. And
Thank you. Deeply appreciate it, Rick.
Absolutely. And for Vincent, I wanted to say I love what you guys have done with The Joker's Wild. At first I wasn't so sure, but I've really grown into it, and I really love what Snoop Dogg is doing with the show. So I wanted
thank
to ask you. Oh, absolutely. I'm wondering what you think the future of late night original broadcast game shows are.
Late night original broadcast game shows?
Yeah, because it almost seems like it happens, but it's almost like a new thing, these original broadcasts, where most other networks kind of run, like, rerun game shows, or there aren't game shows at all. I just think it's a kind of a new genre.
Well, it's funny. They're treating it like a new genre, but game shows are a staple of television. They have been since the get-go. And the reason for that is they are actually the most interactive you can be. And for the medium, and with the advent of the internet and, you know, games like HQ, which just further the form, you realize that it's truly engaging television, and it's also much cheaper to produce than a scripted show. And especially in late night, you can be a little bit more randy with your material, and it's actually fun and engaging to watch. You can participate. It's shout at the TV, television, and you know it's tough to try and build a game where you can play along on a device. But we're getting there. That's getting closer. The challenge on the bigger spectrum is because of the different time zones, it gets kind of tough to do. But eventually, that's going to be a big part of this. I think game shows will always be around, and whether it's prime time, late night, or daytime, there's always, because they're also reflective of the country and where we are, like everything else. And I think that there's always going to be place for it. I've been working on game shows since I started with Millionaire, which is like 20 years ago. And I didn't really know anything about games prior to that other than what I knew when I was a kid. And I've consistently worked, and now I've got at least 12 projects in development because there's a demand for it. And you watch the Amazons of the world and the Netflix of the world will eventually be looking to game because it is engaging and interactive. Everything is gamified. Watch Jimmy Fallon plays games all the time. That's what they love. And Ellen DeGeneres plays them all day on her show. And David Hurwitz produces a great show with her at night, Game of Games. They're not coming back. They've never left. It's just that every once in a while they forget about them. And now they're a staple. And thank God, hopefully they'll stay for a long time.
Cool. Well, definitely enjoying the show and continued success for Shizzle.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Vincent.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
Happy birthday again, Simon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Rich. Really appreciate, Rick. I really appreciate it. Take care of everybody down there. Enjoy. Rick, we're going to from Philadelphia right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Unfortunately, we have to leave this segment. We could go another half hour or more with you, Ben. It's just really, really crazy, but really wonderful. But let me tell everybody, once again, tonight, third season premiere of Snoop Dogg presents The Joker's Wild. Remember, it's on TNT now, and it's on right after Drop the Mic. And that's from 10 to 11 o'clock Eastern and Pacific Time, with Joker's Wild starting at 10:30. And then the following night, Thursday, same time period, same two shows on TBS. For more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.tntdrama.com. And check a look. This is where TNT is available in your area on cable and satellite. The Joker's Wild, hosted by Snoop Dogg, tonight, 10:30 Eastern and Pacific. And don't forget, coming up later this year, the fourth season of the $100,000 Pyramid, hosted by Michael Strahan, live from New York, right here on ABC, on your local ABC station. This is Reno, executive producer on both shows, Joker's Wild and Pyramid. Thank you again for joining us. Always a pleasure. Let's do this again very, very soon. Good luck.
Thank you, Simon.
First season premiere tonight and Pyramid coming up later.
Thanks, buddy. Happy birthday. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And by the way, next time we'll talk Money Drop also, which I understand that Strahan is developing for down the road too.
Exactly. Looking forward to it.
All right, same here, Vincent. Take care.
Take care now. Bye, Simon.
Vincent Urbino, executive producer of the $100,000 Pyramid and Super Dog Presents the Joker's Wild, joining me here in New York. Before we reach the top of the hour, let's get to our Clapper Trivia question of the week. Oh, yeah, it's about game shows. We posted it first on Monday, and the question is, name the original host of Name That Tune in the early 1950s. Name the original host of Name That Tune back in 1952. We've already had a number of people give us some answers. Unfortunately, some very interesting ones. One person, that's a Wink Martindale. Well, Wink actually did a Name That Tune spinoff, if you will, not by the same producers, for NBC in the early 60s called What's That Song? It also started as a show in Los Angeles called What's the Name of That Song? Then when it went network on NBC, it became What's That Song with celebrities. It was around for about a year. Did quite well, too. Rick Stein. But he wasn't it. And neither was Dennis James, who did a daytime version of Name That Tune in the early 70s, also on NBC. So thanks to those of you that put those entries in. Sorry, they're not correct. So keep trying. Again, the question, name the original host of Name That Tune back in 1952. If you know the answer, email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. If you first put the correct answer, you will win the 6-CD set, John Edward, Developing Your Own. We're going for our third weekly winner in a row. So play in. You may be the one that wins. It's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. If we don't get a winner by the end of today, we'll post the question again tomorrow on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. And remember, in order to win, you got to be in, so do so and hold the very best. When we come back, Michael Amo, he is the creator and showrunner of Pure, which premieres tonight on WGN America. It's a mix of crime drama and subculture drama. He will join us from Canada after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. www.blogtalkradio.com and speaker.com, more than 30 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Remember, it's your home for Kings in the Morning. Check out Jay King and Crew tomorrow, 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific. Kings in the Morning, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best BTR 24/7 on YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Marvin Televised, and welcome to those of you just joining us after the top of the hour. Simon, I'm with you live from New York. Second three episodes we're doing this week. Happy to have you along. It's my birthday, too. So welcome in. And if you have a question or comment for our guest ahead, give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04, and then we welcome guests 207 into the room. WGN America, which is available in about 80 million households across the country on cable and satellite, has its first original series, scripted series, premiering tonight. It's called Pure. And the people at WGN are so high on it, they've already ordered a second set of episodes that will premiere later this year. It's a mix of crime drama and drama about a subculture, the Mennonites. And joining me now from Brunswick, Nova Scotia, an innovative system, the creator and showrunner of Pure, Michael Amo. Michael, good to have you here.
Hey, Simon. Happy birthday.
Thank you, thank you. And again, thank you again for joining us. Michael, how are things going? Get ready for the premiere tonight.
WGN is really swinging for the fences with this, I think, so I'm excited to have the show finally exposed to an American audience.
You know, Michael, in all of the crime drama shows that GN has done so far, there's always a subtext of a social issue. And in your case, it's not just a social issue, it's a subculture. I'd like to get your thoughts about how you decided to interplay crime with this study of the Mennonites and what they're up to.
Yeah, about a decade ago, I came across a magazine article called The Wages of Sin, which is about these Mennonites in Mexico and this old colony Mennonites who'd fallen on hard times and, as a result, gone into business with their neighbors who just happened to be this Mexican drug cartel. And I have to emphasize, this is a very small percentage of the population, a couple of bad apples. But anyway, they started moving weed into meth and then finally got into cocaine. And my grandparents were Mennonites, so I was always looking for a kind of a contemporary Trojan horse kind of story device that would allow me to kind of dig into that world. So when I came across this article, I thought this is perfect, this collision of these kind of, religious values versus kind of the worldly nature of drug trafficking just seemed too good to walk past.
So when you formulated this series, first of all, how long did it take you to put this series together and get the exposure on WGN? And secondly, as a writer and showrunner, how do you balance out the crime elements with the study of this unique religious sect?
These are excellent questions. It took a long time to get it to WGN. We produced it first for CBC and season one, and then WGN came on board for season two, decided to run season one first, which makes perfect sense. But, I mean, from the time that I found the article and started pitching and then writing to actually going to air, it was more than 10 years. So, to your second question, how do I balance the crime elements with the social elements? Well, I really, you know, I'm a storyteller. I want to keep the story moving. So I defer to kind of, you know, the plot elements to keep the train on the track and keep people excited. But I do, you know, look for moments, big character moments for the main character and his wife, you know, trapped in this dilemma. So I think I defer to the crime stuff, but I think once people are hooked, you have the opportunity now and then to just to dive into their personal lives a little more.
And by the way, you should know that Michael, before starting Pure, had a hit on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border with The Listener, which, by the way, is now being seen in syndication on many TV stations across the country. It's being paired with a brand-new series that's being offered this week at the NAPI convention down in Miami. And Listener doing quite well. I remember it was on NBC for at least a year or two, and it's been a long-running hit. It was also on ION Television also for a couple of years as well. So talk about the main characters in Pure and how you bring the plot together.
Well, the main character is this the pastor, newly elected, first episode one. He's chosen by lot by his community. In this particular community, they don't go to divinity school or anyways. They're chosen from among their own ranks, you know, just a normal farmer kind of. He's a dairy farmer, and he's chosen by his community, and actually it's sort of chosen by lot. So the idea is that God himself sort of has a hand in the selection of the pastor. And soon after he's selected as his community's pastor, he finds out that there's a couple of people in his Ontario community who are kind of the end of this Mexican drug pipeline. So he takes it upon himself to, because he's, you know, he's been chosen by God to get rid of the few bad apples in his community. But by doing so, he creates a vacuum in the organization, and the ultimate boss down in Mexico says, well done, you've got rid of my guys in Ontario. Since you've done that, now you're in charge. So at that moment, sort of a window closes, but a door opens for Noah, and he decides, well, if God has chosen me for this mission, he's chosen me for this mission, so I'll say yes to this crime lord who doesn't give him much choice anyway. He's going to execute his family if he says no. So Noah says yes, and from that moment, he decides it's his mission to get all the way down to Mexico and to take down the top guy of the Mennonite mob.
Mm-hmm. You're hearing Michael Amo. He is the creator and showrunner of Pure. It's WGN America's first original scripted series of this year, and it premieres tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. WGN America available on cable and satellite all over the U.S. of A. Michael joins us live from Brunswick, Nova Scotia, this half hour, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, right here this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. So I'm back with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment for Michael, ring it in, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Numbers good anywhere. Catch us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker, or use our chat room, as Guest 217 is doing. It's SimonApple04 by name. You'll find our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Don't forget, coming up Friday on Tomorrow Will Be Televised, Audrey Morrissey, the executive producer of The Voice on NBC, and Mark Reisman, the former Frasier writer-producer, who's now doing his own family sitcom for the first time. It premieres Friday on Disney Channel. It's called Sydney to the Max. Michael, where did you film Pure, and how did it contribute to the atmosphere that you wanted?
Yeah, the story is set in southwestern Ontario. We shot it here in Nova Scotia. There's a place called the Annapolis Valley, which bears a striking visual similarity to southwestern Ontario. And I think, you know, our access to this virgin farmland, which is sort of this Mennonite ideal, they believe in this plain lifestyle, they believe in farming, and believe that keeps them close to God. So I think by actually getting out into the farmland and spending a larger part of the series shooting in this beautiful kind of surroundings, I think it really, you know, brings the audience closer to this Mennonite ideal of how life should be.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the cast. You have some interesting people who we've seen from other shows. For example, Ryan Robbins, who was on Arrow, still a big hit on the CW. Falling Skies, really, I enjoyed that show on TNT. And The Killing, a marvelous program from Venus Sur that was on AMC and both on Netflix. And the other main cast character is played by Alex Penton Bresley, I believe it is, who did The Strain on FX.
Yeah, Alex Paxton Beasley is an amazing actor. She plays the role of Anna, who's the mom who, once her husband decides to go on this chaotic mission of taking down the drug lord, she's the one who gets left behind to try to run the family farm and keep the family safe from the bad guys, and she did an excellent job. Ryan Robbins, as you say, is already well known from all of his work in the sci-fi genre. To be quite honest, I didn't know his work. I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, so I was thrilled as a writer to see him bring the character to life in such a compelling and yet darkly humorous way. He knows his way around a joke. So I think there is a lot of dark humor in the show, and both Alex and Ryan managed to kind of straddle a tone between drama and dark humor.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that WGN America, when they have done crime dramas, usually like to bring a subtext in, a social issue like police brutality or how crime is depicted in the media, both when the crime is committed and afterward. When you were dealing with your writers in putting this first season together, did that subject come up? Like, what do we want to touch on socially with this series, especially in terms of maybe because we're dealing with a religious sect, our perception of religion or how religion works in our daily life or doesn't work?
Yeah, no, it's, again, I was interested in the Mennonite angle because I have some family history there. I was specifically interested in how they deal with the onslaught of modernity, how they deal with technology, how most of us live out of these out of the lives box. We're born, we just go through life not really thinking that, we have a choice. We don't have to drive cars. We don't have to have the internet in our life. It's a difficult life if you don't. But what I admire about the Mennonites, I think, is their decision to say, no, we're going to lead a godly life. And if there's any devices, if there's any kind of behaviors that we feel take us away from God, then we just won't allow it into our lives. And I think, given how homogenous most of our society is, I think theirs is this admirable kind of stance. It's very difficult. It doesn't always work. They create these kind of insular communities where there's not much influence from the outside. So there's can be a tendency towards some bad behavior as well. But that's what attracted me to them, was their kind of brave stance against this kind of tidal wave of technology that we experience these days.
Mm-hmm. I understand that Rosie Perez at least has a guest shot on one of the episodes or has a continuing character. I know Rosie. I've enjoyed her career for years from Living Color on. I always like to work with her.
It was great. It's funny, when I was doing the research way back when, I was talking to this woman who was working for the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics and Tobacco, I think, I forget the exact name, but I she was mentioned in the magazine article. I called her up. We had a great conversation. And when I went away to write the first six episodes, I remembered her, and I created a character kind of inspired by this woman. And then Rosie came in and she played the character. I didn't envision Rosie. It's interesting, but Rosie really wanted a challenge. She wanted to play a woman from Texas with a Texas accent. So it's not something you'd normally expect from Rosie Perez, but I think because she made that choice, I think it's a very interesting take on the character. And she was a joy to work with. I mean, she flew up to Nova Scotia, which, let's face it, is not the center of film production in the universe. And she was a team player right from the get-go. So she was a great addition to the team.
You've had the experience of working on both a show that's procedural-like, where you have to every week have a situation and conclude it one way or the other by the end of the episode, by the end of the hour. In this case, you have a miniseries kind of format where you're building up a main plot and subsidiary plots over the course of, in this case, six episodes, and then if you want to continue it into season two. What's it like for you to work both ends of this scale of scripted television? The procedural scale, where it's all contained in an hour, episode by episode versus the miniseries where you're able to stretch the story out?
Well, I have to say my heart lies with the more serialized mode of storytelling. What I loved about, I mean, I found the, you know, case per episode in The Listener was a bit challenging because it was sort of like Amnesia, you know, that the story would start up again and the characters were kind of the same, more or less. Whereas with Pure, I could treat all six episodes as sort of one big episode, and literally I could break it out on my wall in index cards and I could sort of see the entire season at a glance. And that was so liberating because there's such a continuity for all the characters from episode to episode. All their journeys are incremental and you can track them all, and just, you can see real growth in the characters, which is something that you often cannot get in a procedural. So I did love the serialized aspect of Pure.
What does it say to you that WGN believes so strongly in your series that they said, even before we premiere the first batch of six, go ahead and make more?
Well, you know, I'm blown away by their support. They've been fantastic. I mean, particularly bringing it to an American audience, which is so much bigger than a Canadian audience. I think our show has the right elements for a WGN audience. As you say, it's crime plus social issues. So, yeah, I mean, they've got faith in it, so I've got faith in them. I've seen, you know, what they're doing to promote it, and I'm extremely gratified.
Yeah, I've seen the trailer for Pure. It's also been running, by the way, on Tribune. WGN is owned by Tribune, and Tribune's local stations, including WPX here in New York, has now been running the trailer as well as individual promo spots, which is great on their part. And also, some of the cable networks are now running also the spots for your series. And I have to say, there's a tension that really builds in this series, and you see it in both the environment, but also among the individual characters.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I mean, when I originally conceived the show, I was thinking it would be like a 55-minute kind of per episode kind of cable show. We ended up in in a rather more conventional 44-minute sort of setting. But what's interesting about that distillation is that it sort of boiled everything down, you know, plot-wise to its essence. So as a consequence, you know, the story moves quickly and there's a great concentration of just of jeopardy and tension. So it was an unintended consequence of, you know, shrinking the running time, but I think it actually had a positive effect on the whole show. So other people have described it to me as a sore neck show where you're just sitting there tense watching it the whole time. So I'm happy to hear that. You know, I go up to my kids' hockey games and I get people coming up to me when it was aired in Canada saying, asking me what's going to happen next. I've never worked on anything, including The Listener, where there was just so much kind of week-to-week interest. So I'm really, you know, excited for the show, as I say, to be shown in the U.S. as well.
You're hearing Michael Amo. He's the creator and showrunner of Pure, WGN America's new drama series, and it premieres tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. First set of episodes, and the second set will be coming your way later this year on WGN America, available to more than 80 million households on cable and satellite. Michael joins us live from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon, I'm with you live from New York. Delighted to have you with us. Stay tuned. We have a very special announcement that will impact the future of this show. That's coming up in a bit. And if you have a question or comment for Michael, make that call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. My name, guest 217, is in the room. Remember, a week from Friday on the program, among our guests, we will have Devon Gregory. He is the creator and showrunner of BET's new series, American Soul, dealing with the beginnings of Soul Train. That's coming up a week from Friday, our first February episode, on the 1st of February, no doubt, right here on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. You know, Michael, over, I think, the last decade, I think there's been a real transformation in the thinking down here about shows produced out of Canada. It used to be, if a show is produced in Canada, it's got to be low budget, low in terms of writers, second-class citizen, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, I think because of shows like yours, because of Flashpoint, X Factor, and with the on Netflix, a number of other shows that they're doing for up there, there seems to be a real transformation. I think more respect for shows that are originating in Canada and make their way into American television. What do you think?
Well, I don't think the reputation of Canadian TV down there, the perception of it as being kind of a knockoff is entirely undeserved. I think, you know, our networks here are far more conservative in what they commission. And, but I think, you know, there's the right, I belong to the Writers Guild up here. I'm the counselor for Atlantic Canada. And I know among the writing community here that we watch American television and, you know, it, as people say, it's the golden age of television. It's hard not to be inspired by the storytelling of The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or great shows like that. And we want to do the very same work. And a lot of my friends, frankly, have left Canada to move to the States. But those of us who stayed behind are really trying to push the envelope. And when we find kind of a, you know, a friend among the network executives here, as we did at CBC, you know, we seize the opportunity to push the envelope and make work that we feel kind of, you know, is can be held up, you know, side by side with the amazing shows down in the U.S. So it's true. I mean, our budgets, just it's the way it is up here, are slightly smaller. So, we, you know, what we lack in budget, we have to sort of make up for in storytelling panache and just the sheer hook of the show. Like Pure is like Mennonite drug dealer. So that's high concept. So I think that also helps the show and helps kind of penetrate a very noisy market in the U.S. But yeah, and there's a lot of great writers, a lot of great ideas up there. And I think more and more you're going to see, you know, hopefully our networks pushing the envelope in an attempt to kind of make some noise in the international market.
And I think it was a great move, by the way, by Netflix last year to establish a fund to help get Canadian produced shows off the ground so they can be seen worldwide, like Anne with an E, which has Wally Beckett, the former Emmy-winning writer of Breaking Bad, and did a ballet drama for Stars that was very highly regarded, produced here in New York, doing that show. And I've seen Amber, and it's a marvelous program. Northern Rescue is another one that they, I think is coming soon from Netflix. So it's great to see the Canadian television, I think, is getting far more respect than it's ever been. And I agree with you. I think it's been an undeserved situation. I've seen Canadian shows from the 80s, the 70s, 60s that were really well done. I still remember a crime drama called Wojciech with John Vernon, a show called Little's Hobo, which is a terrific children's program, great family show, not just a laughy knockoff, because I like the storytelling of it. A lot of good shows along the way that I think were very well done, as I said, particularly in the last year, which last few years, with shows like Flashpoint, Rookie Blue, 10 Days in the Valley, and so forth, featuring Canadian writers who can hold their own with anybody.
Yeah, no, I just think the boundaries are dissolving. And the networks, you know, have to face up to the fact that they have to compete on an international stage. They've got to make content that not only attracts American viewers, but viewers internationally. So, you know, we can't afford to be parochial if we ever were. But I think now more than ever, as you say, we're stepping up and creating some compelling content.
Mm-hmm. How will the second season evolve from the first?
The second season, we just finished that back in the fall. I mean, I would just say the first season's all about Noah and Anna, the husband and wife, trying to hang on to this kind of little corner of heaven that they've created for themselves in this Mennonite community against all odds, against the depredations of this drug cartel. And season two, without giving too much away, I think is all about them having been cast out of heaven, trying to fight their way back. And that's probably as much as I should say about season two.
Mm-hmm. Are you already starting to think, where can I take this show if I get the opportunity to do a third season, a fourth season? Are you already starting to think, where do I want to take this?
Yeah, I've always had in the back of my mind four seasons. I mean, it'd be great to have actually more episodes per season, because I find with six, you always feel like a race car on its side, on two wheels, just trying to turn the corner as you try to tell the story. It's a very compact kind of timeline. But yeah, I've always seen four, you know, and it's always been for me, the whole show was sort of, you know, all about one man's spiritual journey. He's, you know, God chooses him to be his emissary, his pastor. It's all about this fella fighting for his faith, trying to find God, trying to serve God. And I think, you know, at some point he loses God and then he rediscovers God again. So for me, the core of the show is all about Noah Funk's spiritual journey and the consequences that journey has on everybody around him.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, I want to mention two other examples of good family drama programming that came out of Canada in recent years. One is Heartland, which is the longest running show of its kind, I understand, which is also carried in New York, in the United States on Up Network. I think it's on like Sunday nights at 7 o'clock and continues to do well. And the other, which was a show that was done with Mickey Rooney, for the Family Channel, The Adventures of the Black Stallion, ran four seasons, terrific show, very well done, was done in both Canada and France, I might add, in other parts of Europe, and it had a very good following here in the United States on the Family Channel, which co-produced the show. Another great example of good half-hour storytelling, by the way, so just wanted to bring that to your attention. And we're happy that over the last half hour we brought to your attention Pure. It's the first new scripted series of the year for WGN America. It premieres tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. And you can also check out Michael's work on some stations around the country of The Listener, his long-running series Beforehand. It's going into a second season syndication through Program Partners, Inc., and it's being paired with another show, by the way, down at the NAPI convention going on right now in Miami on TV stations all over the country. For more details about WGN America and Pure, online, here's where you go, www.wgnamerica.com. That's www.wgnamerica.com. Pure starts tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern at Pacific Time. Michael Amo, the creator and showrunner, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on the success so far. Good luck with tonight's premiere, and hopefully we'll get that fourth season or more run. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Hey, Simon, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Same here. Take care. Enjoy.
Okay, thanks, buddy. Take care.
Primo, creator and showrunner of Pure on WGN America, beginning time 10 p.m. Pacific Time, joining us live from Brunswick, New Mexico. Before we leave you, I have a very special announcement, perfect timing with my birthday today. And that is that for many years I've been writing on a recurring basis for Media Village, great website. We've had some of the editors of that program and the founder, Jack Myers, on other episodes of the show. I'm thrilled to tell you I'm going to be expanding that relationship starting in a few weeks. I'll be writing a weekly column dealing with the future of television for Media Village at MediaVillage.com. But that's not all. We're all going to try to integrate Tomorrow Be Televised with Media Village in a number of ways. One is to try to get Media Village on other podcasts and websites. Another is to expose Media Village to the Media Village audience and regular readership to Tomorrow Be Televised in podcasts and other ways, and also perhaps to originate the show from Media Village's new offices in Midtown Manhattan. So stay tuned. I'm very, very excited about the move and making this happen, and I'm looking forward to expanding this relationship and really encouraging more people to listen to this program all about television that we've been doing for 11 and a half years. So thank you, Media Village. Thank you, Jack Myers, for the trust you have in me. We're not going to let you down. We're going to really step it up with this program and writing for Media Village. And if you haven't seen Media Village, give it a try. I think we'll really enjoy reading about where the media is at, where it's going, at www.mediavillage.com. www.mediavillage.com. So thank you, Jack, Evie Moss, everybody, Ed Martin, everybody involved in making Media Village happen. It's a pleasure to have more involvement with you and our show along with it. Coming Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, Ashley Morrissey from The Voice on NBC and Mark Reisman from the new Disney Channel comedy, Sydney to the Max. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up an episode you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version anytime you like at iHeartRadio.com. Also at iTunes, Apple TV, and Speakers podcast app. Remember, you can always be in touch with us at SimonApple04@yahoo.com. You can also find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. We love hearing from you because what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not only those of Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and iHeart Radio. At BTR, Production Associates Candace Williams, Andy Cho's Blog Talk Radio's General Manager, Jay Sonnenberg, Executive Content Producer, the co-founders of Enterprise are Al Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow Televised is brought today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world for three free audiobooks and a one-month trial. AudibleTrial.com/televised. They're proud development partners of the annual New York Television Festival. But Tomorrow Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for all the birthday wishes. Have a great rest of your Wednesday. We're back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific. You know where, Blog Talk Radio. Whatever you're doing this day, even if it's your birthday also, make it safe and make it great. And thank you all again for your listening and support. Until next time, be well and stay tuned.